Next, we're going to give you the dirt on dust. Even the most well-scrubbed homes will have some dust build up somewhere. And the reason to remove dust is not just aesthetic. As NPR's Joe Palca reports, dust has some potentially harmful stuff in it.
As they used to say in Elizabethan times, how dost thou? I tend to favor a vacuum. On the other hand, nature abhors a vacuum. But before we get into removing dust, let's talk a bit about what dust is and how it gets into your house.
Outdoor soil particles that come in on your shoes.
Paloma Beamer is on the faculty of the University of Arizona in Tucson and something of a dustologist. Outdoor soil is one element in dust. Another is the tiny particles in air that float in when you open a window or door. And then there's the indoor component of dust.
Like pieces of your carpet fiber or your furniture, or your bedding, or anything like that that starts decaying.
The indoor components also include certain bits of organic matter.
A lot of our skin flakes and dander off your pets and other insects or bugs that might be in the home.
Now, as anyone who's looked under a sofa knows, there's dense dust and there's fluffy dust.
So a lot of the fluffy things, I think, tend to do more when you get a lot of fibers. In my house, it comes from cat hair.
Beamer is interested in dust because it's one way people can be exposed to toxic substances. For example, for someone living near a toxic waste site, some of those chemicals can end up in house dust. The question is, how much? In a recent paper in the journal Environmental Science and Technology, she calculates the proportion of dust that's from indoor sources compared to outdoor.
The indoor percentage would be around 34%, and then the two-thirds from outdoor comes both from soil track-in and the outdoor air particles.
But to understand the potential for exposure, it's also crucial to understand how dust can get into your body. Turns out, for dust, size matters.
The big thing about particles and breathing particles is the size of those.
Andrea Ferro is also a dust expert. She's at Clarkson University in Potsdam, New York. She says some of the particles are small enough that they can float in the air and we can breathe them into our lungs. Others are larger and tend to sink more rapidly to the ground. One thing that's remarkable about dust is that it sticks around. Ferro says without vacuuming, it can stick around for a long time.
And we're finding things like DDT in many indoor dust samples. Well, we haven't had, we banned that decades ago, but it's still there.
In addition to breathing in dust through your nose, you can also swallow it. Duke University's Heather Stapleton is an environmental chemist. She says you may not be in the habit of licking the floors or carpets in your home, but some younger members of your household might be doing essentially that.
Being a parent of a six-month-old, I can't tell you how many times I look at my son and I see him with his hands in the mouth all the time or picking up a toy and putting it in his mouth. So it's incredibly difficult to quantify what mass of dust they're actually exposed to and any contaminants associated with that dust, but it definitely occurs.
Stapleton says it's really hard to estimate just how much exposure a person has to the chemicals in dust. But obviously, reducing the amount of dust will reduce your exposure.
Keeping a well-dusted home, a well-vacuumed home, will reduce the dust in your home the most.
Paloma Beamer says you want to get a good vacuum, and if it has one, change the bag before it gets too full.
And it's important to remind yourself to not just vacuum your floor, but also your upholstered furniture.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Okay, more work to do. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Dusting the globe. This is NPR News.
Bluefin tuna is one of the most valuable fish in the sea. A single bluefin tuna can fetch $100,000 at market before it's cut into sushi. But it's been severely overfished, so it's also one of the most endangered fish in the sea. Over the weekend, the International Commission that regulates fishing voted to reduce the quota for bluefin tuna. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, the new quota still allows too much fishing to assure the tuna's survival.
Every year since its inception decades ago, the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas gets together to set fishing limits for the bluefin tuna. And every year, the commission has ignored the advice of its own scientists. It's under heavy pressure from the fishing industry, particularly boats working the waters off Europe, who want to catch far more fish than the scientists say is safe. But this year, for a change, the commission suggested a quota that falls within the range of their scientists' advice. And Jane Lubchenco, who heads the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, says this new quota is a significant improvement.
But it does not go far enough. It's insufficient to guarantee the long-term viability of either the fish or the fishery.
Lubchenco, as a biologist, is passionate about bluefin tuna. And Lubchenco also has a responsibility as the nation's chief fishing regulator to protect the species from being fished to commercial extinction.
Bluefin tuna are spectacular creatures, and we have a responsibility to ensure their survival. We also understand that the survival of the fishery depends on having healthy populations of fish.
The latest deal establishes a new lower fishing quota and also puts in place new rules designed to reduce overfishing. Even so, the commission itself figures even if these rules are followed, there's only a 60% chance that the species will recover by the year 2023.
That's not a high probability, but it's much better than the current probability.
The chances of recovery are based on the assumption that fishermen will actually keep to the quotas that have been negotiated. Joseph Powers at Louisiana State University is a science advisor to the Tuna Commission, and he says the new quota looks okay, at least on paper.
If, in fact, that were perfectly implemented, then yes, you would start to begin the long recovery process.
But the fisheries, particularly around Europe, have a dreadful track record in implementing tuna quotas. Susan Lieberman at the Pew Environment Group says some European nations do a very poor job of enforcing the quotas.
And there's a lot of illegal fishing going on, again, particularly in the Mediterranean.
She says fishermen sometimes catch twice as many fish as they are allowed under the formal quotas. So even though the Tuna Commission has finally paid attention to its scientists on eastern bluefin tuna, Lieberman is still very discouraged.
I would say it's not really so much a turning point as a baby step in the right direction. I don't know if the bluefin tuna has enough time for all the little tiny steps, but it's better than nothing.
Lieberman says the commission probably went as far as it did because conservation groups, including hers, are trying to get bluefin tuna protected as an endangered species under a treaty called CITES. The government of Monaco has made that a formal proposal. Commissioners hope they could forestall that action if they took serious enough steps at this meeting. The U.S. government strongly supports Monaco's efforts to ban bluefin tuna trade, but today NOAA Administrator Jane Lubchenco was a bit noncommittal about what exactly that means.
Because the meetings have just concluded, we haven't had time to consult within the U.S. government and to decide exactly what our next steps are. We're going to be doing that very soon.
That next crucial meeting for the bluefin tuna is slated for March. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And as we just heard, the American and Chinese presidents spoke of fighting climate change, which is not going to be easy. World leaders no longer expect to agree on a climate treaty in time for a big meeting planned next month in Copenhagen. It is just as hard to build consensus inside the United States, and some environmental groups are growing impatient with President Obama. Their concern is not so much what the president does, it's what the president says and what he doesn't say. NPR's Don Gagne has our report.
It was this way during the presidential campaign, and it remains so under President Obama when making the case for reducing greenhouse gas emissions for higher mileage automobiles or for reducing America's dependency on foreign oil. His message has been very consistent. Whenever he talks environment, he also talks about jobs.
Of energy, wind power and solar power and the next generation of biofuels, an investment that will lead to new industries and 5 million new jobs that pay well and can't be outsourced.
That is from his acceptance speech to the Democratic National Convention in Denver in the summer of 08. This is from a weekly presidential radio address this year.
It's a plan that will trigger the creation of millions of new jobs for Americans who will produce the wind turbines and solar panels.
And this past week in Tokyo, the president looked ahead to the UN Climate Change Conference set for December in Copenhagen. He spoke of the urgency to address the problem. He said he has no illusions that it will be easy. Then came the jobs pitch.
The good news is that if we put the right rules and incentives in place, it will unleash the creative power of our best scientists, engineers, and entrepreneurs. It will lead to new jobs, new businesses, and entire new industries.
In public, the president never makes the case for addressing global warming in environmental terms alone. That bothers Damon Moglen, who works on climate change for Greenpeace.
You do not see the president doing what he has done on health care, going out into the public and explaining the problems of climate change and demanding from the Congress a science-based policy commensurate with the risks we face. We need to see much more leadership from Mr. Obama.
As for the decision to always link climate change to jobs, Moglen says,
of course there are green jobs in this process, but the fact is the president now gives speeches in which he doesn't even mention the phrases climate change or global warming.
Another environmental activist, Jonathan Lash of the World Resources Institute, says the White House approach makes political sense, especially today. He says the president is being pragmatic.
We're in the depths of the most serious recession that the United States has faced since the Great Depression. We're at 10% unemployment, and that's what Americans are concerned about. They need to know that taking action now is not something that will prolong the recession, but will help us out of the recession.
Meanwhile, in the United States Senate, Colorado Democrat Mark Udall disagrees that the White House is moving too cautiously on the issue. He says the change from the Bush administration is huge.
Were the previous administration still in office, we would be debating the science of climate change. We would be debating here whether to even send a delegation to Copenhagen. Under this administration, we're fully participating.
But Udall, who has longstanding ties to the environmental community, does say that he hears firsthand the frustration of those who insist that the president be more aggressive.
I have to defend both the president and myself in town hall meetings from people who are impatient, and I appreciate that impatience. Time is moving along, and you have a number of other competitors around the world. China, the Germans, the Danes, India are all moving very rapidly to invest in clean energy and technologies,
which he worries will give those countries a competitive advantage in the green economy marketplace. Udall says he expects the White House to step up the pressure on climate change next year, once the fight over health care is finished. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Rainforests are often cut down and coral reefs are overfished by poor people who are struggling to get by. There are hundreds of aid projects around the world that try to protect these habitats. The idea is to create other methods for the poor to make money. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, a young scientist traveled to the Central Pacific to investigate whether these programs work, and she was shocked at what she found.
The island nation of Kiribati has a very simple economy. People either catch fish or they pick coconuts from their trees and produce coconut oil.
Most people have a little bit of land and they have access to the coral reefs, and so they should easily be able to switch between the two, and they do, actually.
Sheila Walsh is a postdoctoral researcher at Brown University. She says the government of Kiribati had a program that was designed to protect the fish on the reef by subsidizing the local coconut industry.
The thought was that by paying people more to do coconut agriculture, they would do less fishing, and that this would fulfill two goals. One, they would reduce overfishing, and two, that people would be better off. They'd have higher incomes.
Walsh wanted to know whether this plan was working, and the government said, go ahead, find out. So, as part of her graduate studies at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, she flew to Kiribati to interview fishermen.
And it turned out that actually the result of paying people more to do coconut agriculture was actually to increase fishing.
How could that be?
Right. It was a bit of a surprise, and we were wondering what's going on here.
The answer was simplicity itself. Her study concludes that people earned more money making coconut oil, which meant that they could work less to support themselves. And they spent their new leisure time fishing.
It hit us like a bumper sticker saying, you know, a bad day fishing is better than a good day of working. And I think that's sort of the story here.
The impact on the reef was distressing. The fish population had dropped to even lower levels, putting the whole ecosystem at risk. It turns out that Walsh had stumbled into a universal truth about fishing. Fishermen aren't just in it for the money. Anthropologist Richard Polnack at the University of Rhode Island says, just think of those snazzy sport fishing excursions.
People pay big money to go sports fishing.
Fishing as an occupation provides psychic benefits as well as money. Polnack argues not just individuals, but whole cultures get hooked on the thrill of being out on the water and the gamble of coming back with either a boatload or empty-handed.
This type of an occupation selects for a certain type of personality, and that personality type will not be happy in many other occupations other than fishing.
As a result, attempts to get fishermen to do something else, even something that pays better, often end in failure, Polnack says.
There have been projects where they had vessel buyback programs, and almost 50% of the fishermen used that money to buy another boat and do another type of fishing, and in some cases get right back into fishing.
The track record for international projects is poorly studied, which makes Sheila Walsh's research notable. Polnack says he can't point to any real successes.
A great deal of the international development money, I would argue, is basically wasted.
This problem is not lost on Craig Lesher at the Nature Conservancy. His organization does spend money to help fishermen seek other livelihoods, but does it keep them out of their boats?
Well, no. It doesn't work to get them off the water, rarely.
So he says the Nature Conservancy funds non-fishing jobs as a tactic to help during a transition. For example, fishermen may need a temporary source of income when a new no-fishing zone is established. Fishermen lose their fishing income for a while until the regional fish population recovers.
What we have found with our research is that a lot of alternative income activities are not successful in the long term. So what we do is just look for activities that can benefit communities just in the near term, the next 2 or 3 years.
Which brings us back to the island nation of Kiribati. Sheila Walsh says the government there is now trying to figure out how to fix the problem of overfishing, which it had accidentally made worse. Richard Harris, NPR News.
We may think of climate change killing off species or destroying habitat. Now a twist. Tree researchers studying bristlecone pines in California and Nevada have found those trees growing over the last 50 years at a faster rate than at any other period in the last 3,600 years. They were looking at trees at an elevation of almost 12,000 feet at the upper tree line. Malcolm Hughes has been studying those pines, which can be up to 5,000 years old. He's a professor of dendrochronology at the Tree Ring Research Laboratory at the University of Arizona. Welcome.
Thank you.
And first, give us a picture. Describe this bristlecone pine tree. What does it look like?
They almost look like slightly enlarged bonsai. They are very twisted. They're growing in very tough environments. They may not be much more than 15 feet tall, but rather wide with multiple stems. And they're really quite spectacular to look at.
Okay, well, you've been looking at the rings of these bristlecone pines to chart the growth. What do they show?
In the last few decades, they're getting fatter rings than they've had for about 3,600 years. This is a very unusual event. It exists only in the trees near their upper limit, not in the trees just a few hundred feet lower down the mountain. So the mystery was, why on earth is this happening?
And how have you resolved that mystery, or have you?
It was earlier thought, 20 or so years ago, that this was probably mainly the result of there being more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Our results concerning the pattern of where the trees are growing faster and where they are not is not consistent with that explanation. And that leads us to look for another explanation. The most likely one is the increase in temperatures that has taken place over the 20th century, for whatever reason. And we've got some evidence that strongly suggests that that's a big part of this story.
So boil that down for us. What do those conclusions lead you to understand?
We think that temperature is a big part of this change in the high mountains. It's one of many other changes in high mountain environments that we're learning about that have taken place in recent decades. Shifts in the zones where different plants and animals live. Changes in the seasonality, snow melt coming a week or two earlier in much of the West, even flowers of various species known to come into flower or to leaf earlier. Now, in the last few decades, things are different.
Does it give you any kind of thrill still, as much as you've done this, to be looking at a sample of a tree that might be thousands of years old?
Absolutely. It's really just always a wonderful experience. First of all, it's a remarkable thing that they're there and that they're still alive. And then also, of course, to think what else was going on when this ring was growing. Because after all, what we've got there is a little time capsule of each year with the carbon, hydrogen, oxygen that were in the air and in the ground at that time, captured and stored in almost perpetuity.
Well, Malcolm Hughes, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Malcolm Hughes is a professor of dendrochronology. I love saying that. Dendrochronology at the Tree Ring Research Laboratory at the University of Arizona.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.